It just reminds us that plants actually predate human existence, but we still have this piece of nature sitting on our windowsill. I think that that grounds us, and that's important.
This is The Safari. The Safari is a tour around the consumer, brand, and retailing industry. And we have the great privilege here at my company, Traub, to really be exposed to many of the great minds of the industry who are forming and shaping the future of many different parts of the consumer, brand, and retail world. And I felt it was quite interesting for us to be able to not only learn from all of those people as we do every day, but memorialize it into a podcast, which could then be shared with many of our friends and clients and you, obviously, the listener. Welcome back to another episode of The Safari. My name is Morty Singer, and today I'm joined by Eliza Blank, who is the founder of The Sill. In fact, she invented really a whole industry. She is the pioneer of selling potted plants to millennials and now millions of people all over the country and the world, and really bringing nature into people's apartments. And she really believes in the spiritual healing ability of having nature and plants and flowers within one's own four walls, and that she has spurned a whole segment of the internet where people have tried to copy her, I think foolishly. And she is here today to talk to us about building an e-commerce business, in fact now an omni-channel business, because she has her own locations around the United States. And she's an absolutely wonderful, thoughtful human being around how to build a mindful business in the 21st century. So please do stick around. Eliza, thank you so much for joining me on The Safari.
Morty, I'm so glad to be here on a Friday morning, no less.
Oh, absolutely. Well, listen, I've been so looking forward to speaking to you about your incredible company, which frankly is one of the most inspirational stories, bootstrapping an idea over 10 years and then inspiring a whole generation of people to literally decorate their homes with plants, making them happy and giving them a wellness story beyond, you know, taking medicine. You know, plants are good for the soul and for the heart and for the health. And, you know, welcome. And so maybe you'll kick off and give us a little background on The Sill and everything that you have done over the last decade to build it into what it is today. I know it's been a long ride. and so how did it start?
Yeah. So, so you're absolutely right. It's been 10 years, which feels wild. Cause of course we, as people tend to change over the course of 10 years as well. So I've kind of grown up with this business. I started it when I was 26 years old. I'm going to be 37 this year. So it's been a big chunk of my life. So as you mentioned, so I started in 2012 and it was a bootstrapped idea for the first five grueling years before I went on to raise institutional capital. But the business is quite simple. We are the first direct-to-consumer houseplant brand. And our model is omni-channel. So we find our customers primarily online, but we do have a brick-and-mortar store. And in fact, we just opened our ninth location in Park Slope, Brooklyn. But we have stores in New York, Boston, Chicago, LA, and San Francisco, which is super exciting. And we're actually the first to really both modernize the category and approach it from a digital model. So both physical and digital, delivering, it's sort of omni-channel 2.0, if you will. So it's a very unique approach. It's a beloved brand. I like to consider us actually generation defining, if you will, because really houseplants have just exploded amongst the millennial generation. And I'd like to take some credit for that because we've been really pounding the pavement since 2012 about all of the wonderful benefits of plants. And it's quite simple. Our tagline is plants make people happy. And it's why I get up and do what I do every day. And so my story is that, you know, I grew up amongst plants in a very sort of rural, actually, if not suburban, but I'll call it rural, part of Massachusetts. My mother is an avid gardener, lover of houseplants. And so it was a natural backdrop to my childhood. And then, of course, I came to New York City, and it was such a stark contrast to sort of the greenery that surrounded me up until that point. So when I went to go try and fill my house with houseplants, I was just sorely disappointed that there were not a ton of options. And this is a city of so much choice. You know, you can find, I don't know, hundreds of different cups of coffee.
Why not houseplants? And so it's, you know, it's a common founder story. It was something I was passionate about and something I believed in. And so I started it myself, 2012.
And so the business took in institutional capital when?
In 2017, tail end of 2017.
And so bootstrapping for the first half.
Bootstrapped for five and venture backed for five.
So let's talk a little bit about these famous millennials. And I think you, yes. I think you might be within one extreme of that cohort, just barely, but nonetheless, I think you are still in there.
I'm an old millennial. That's true.
So tell me, because you know, what is it about this activity? Because it is an activity. You're taking care of something. It's almost like a pet.
Yeah.
It's a sort of almost a spiritual moment as well. Sort of connectivity through. Cutting through the brick and mortar and all the towers and glass and urban life potentially, but of course not everyone lives in a city, but many young people tend to gravitate to cities.
That's right.
Is that it? Is it sort of trying to cut through the city and try and touch nature and just have a spiritual moment every day, some mindfulness maybe?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, right? So as you can imagine, a lot of our customers do live in urban settings. And, you know, I mentioned where our stores are located. And, you know, a lot of major cities across the country, and that's no coincidence. Now, I think that's one of the reasons why houseplants have become such an important part of this generation, because we are living in these concrete jungles. But, you know, this is the first generation that's also truly glued to the screen. And I think that is not immaterial to our attraction to plants and nature. Now, we as humans actually have an innate desire to connect with living systems, with nature. Biophilia is a term coined by the late biologist E.O. Wilson, and it just describes this basic notion that as humans, we are supposed to be connected with living things. And here we are spending 10 hours at least behind our screens on a daily basis, and that's even before COVID. As Americans, and I know you're not American, but you're here now, we spend 90% of our life inside. That's terrible. And so we crave this connection with nature, and there was never an easy solution. Now, I also like to point out that our generation is the Tamagotchi generation. We like little cute things that we can take care of that, you know, you can sort of dabble with, but there's not a huge threshold for success. So, you know, plants are that. It's not a pet. It's, you know, we're delaying, you know, having children even as a generation. It's not a tremendous amount of responsibility, but it's still a relationship that's reciprocal that you really benefit from. And I think what millennials have tapped into, and other young people, of course, is that emotional connection, that sort of inspiration from plants that you can gather and incorporate into your life, because plants are a wonderful metaphor for life. You know, it's really about personal growth, your ability to nurture and take care of plants. And that, I think, is what's so unique. Now, on the other hand, they're a beautiful element of home decor. And I think, you know, our generation also loves to express our creativity and just general self-expression through our surroundings. And again, another thing that was sort of accelerated through COVID. We spend so much time in the home now. We want it to feel like our sanctuary. We want it to feel like a expression of ourselves, and plants very much help create that environment.
What have you learned from nurturing plants that you can create a correlation to how to nurture and grow a business from scratch?
You know, plants are incredibly resilient, And if there's anything that I can take away, it's plants, they're desperate to survive. And it's funny because a lot of, you know, our customers are first-time plant owners, and they'll come in, they'll say, oh, I kill plants all the time. And it's actually due to over-caring. It's sort of over-nurturing and over-watering. And plants can actually thrive even in a neglectful environment. And it just speaks to their resilience, their pure desire to survive. I mean, we heard all these stories about how offices shut down at the beginning of the pandemic, and people were, you know, returning to their office 6 months later and finding a lot of their plants were still okay. And there's this amazing way for plants to adapt to their environment in order to survive. And I think that I can't be blind to that, because building a business requires, if anything, just utter resilience to survive. And I think that's what I largely take away. That and I'm usually dehydrated, and my plants will remind me. If I'm watering my plants, I probably need a glass of water myself.
There we go. So the let's talk a little bit about the past, present, and future. So the past, yeah. The beginning of the company. So you had this idea, you felt that there was a cultural zeitgeist moment, you had a background and love for plants. But you know, how do you start a website and source product, and how do you, I don't know, were you living in the city at the time? I mean, how does that,
you have to be really naive to start a business. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And so, you know, I mentioned I was 26 years old. I was young. I was full of energy. I was hooked on the entrepreneurial spirit. I'd actually just spent 4 years at another startup in brand marketing, and was so compelled by this idea to launch The Sill that I was going to do whatever it took. And so, you know, the first iteration of this business was was silly. It was a website that you could shop on if you effectively lived near me, because what it meant was, if you were purchasing from the website, I was going to pot that plant for you. I was going to walk over or ride the subway to your apartment and knock on your door and hand it to you. And that was the first business model. It's wild in retrospect that I did that actually for so long. We didn't start shipping nationally until 2014. So 2 years into the business, it was almost exclusively a local delivery business. And even our first store didn't open until 2014, early 2015. So for a long time, it was actually just figuring out the positioning, figuring out who our consumer was, figuring out the supply chain, which was not easy being from outside the horticultural industry, and having a lot of hustle and guts. And like, even for, you know, for the entirety of those 5 years, I wore all the hats. I had to learn how to drive a cargo van. I learned literally everything there is to know about plants. We actually started a B2B service business in those years, which helped with cash flow. But all the time, the concept was resonating with customers. I mean, there was not a day or week that went by that we weren't getting orders. And we were getting a tremendous amount of press because of the novelty of the idea, which helped because I had literally no budget.
Yeah. And so today you have these 10 stores, you have a digital native approach because you started everything online, which is so wonderful today. And obviously many of the big brands and retailers have sort of cottoned onto that and really are mining the data, mining the consumer. Where are they? Where do they live? What's their concentration? And using that to drive real estate decisions. And sometimes that doesn't always help real estate decisions. I think you and I talked about that once, but it can inform real estate decisions. But you referenced earlier omnichannel 2.0. So what does that mean to you in your business 2.0?
Yeah. So I think, we did not coin this term phygital, and it's a slightly awkward word to spit out, but you know, what resonates with me regarding this term is that we have come to have these very high expectations about how the digital and physical worlds work together. And I think that, again, was also accelerated due to COVID, right? All of a sudden we are, you know, my parents are buying their groceries online and picking them up curbside. That took a lot of very quick innovation. And we were actually already well positioned because we already had physical footprints and a digital experience. But what customers expect to happen is a much more seamless exchange between those channels. And that's what we mean when we talk about the digital. And the Sill is really the only brand that sort of sits in this space squarely, whereas you have sort of your, you know, you have online direct businesses now. So certainly we have competitors who are just operating online. You still have, of course, the sort of incumbents of your Home Depots and Lowe's and garden centers who certainly have a very robust physical presence, but less so sort of on the brand and digital space. And then there's a bit of a wholesale business in our industry as well, but nobody's really at this intersection like we are. But I wouldn't call it exclusively omnichannel because I think it's a step ahead of where omnichannel was, you know, call it 5 years ago when it was just about being in multiple channels. It's how your channels are actually integrated and how your customer is moving between them seamlessly.
Yeah. On this podcast, we had Justin Abrams from Flagship Retail, who came out of Red Bull. And so that sort of psychology of activation, community, consumption, and that sort of virtual cycle, as it were, of being wherever the customer is at any time is so important. And which brings me to the question of community, right? So you talk about in some of your materials about this notion of trying to take some of the underpinnings of how people worked in the horticultural world as consumers, I mean, garden clubs and basically leveraging friends and community, but also being alone in their own gardens. So that's a link between the private and then the community, and then trying to update that for this latest generation. What do you do to drive community? Because to me, return on community is what it's all about, right? That's how you maintain customers, because they feel that they belong to something, and nurturing that community. We keep on coming back to that word nurturing on this podcast, but how do you do that? What's your lens for returning the community?
So the reason why I believe we've been successful in community, and a lot of brands talk about community, and you know, I wouldn't go so far as to say that we're experts in it, because I think it evolves so quickly. Both the Sill and just Plant Parenthood, which is a term that we did coin, has become such a strong identifier that you're seeing it show up in people's profiles. You know, it's for the first time, it's in someone's dating profile on their app, or it's in someone's Instagram profile on their app. So they feel very connected to this identity of owning and caring for plants. I think that's sort of the first step. Now, connecting them with each other, I think, is so critical. And this was another thing that was missing from sort of the incumbent experience, or sort of the antiquated experience of, you know, my mother's generation, because gardening clubs and horticultural societies felt very elitist, and they felt very sophisticated in the sense that if you were a novice, like, where did you belong? Certainly you weren't going to go join a horticultural society if you, you know, till, you know, your snake plant. But there's a lot to bond over with that. And the conversation we had earlier around, you know, plants sort of being about home decor and health and wellness and self-care, those are such broad interest spaces to bring people together. And so we do that in a number of ways. We host a tremendous amount of community events online, which are free. So you can join workshops at the Sill. We host at least one a week. We also do a lot of private events, but our workshops online are primarily educational. A lot of Q&A, a lot of sort of introductory, really friendly and approachable material. All of that is free for the consumer base. And then we do that in store as well. Often in store, it's more of a ticketed event. But again, it's about bringing people, like-minded people together in a very wholesome environment to bond over something like plants. It's quite simple, but what it does for the Sill and for the brand is it becomes such an important listening post. So we are a fly on the wall, listening to our customers and discerning from them what is it that they really want from the Sill. And that, I think, is again speaks to the model that we have, and the success of the model is really about how are we using that customer information to propel us forward, to innovate, to inform everything from our marketing to our product assortment, to where we show up in the physical world.
We'll be right back. I want to take a second to explain to you why Traub is able to bring you the safari. We pride ourselves in being at the very center of a very global, very complicated consumer and retail landscape. And in our travels, as we help think, manage, and expand businesses in many different channels and geographies, we're able to meet and learn from some of the great minds in this industry, and it's really wonderful to be able to bring them to you. And in doing so, I hope that you, the listener, will be able to learn a little bit more about what we do at Traub as well. Back to the safari. So speaking of, what do you call it, fidgetal expressions of your brand. You know, Andy Dunn and others have said that when they swore off of doing anything with retail. In fact, they swore off retail, period, yeah. And then opened their own stores. And then they swore off doing anything with department stores or big box retailers. Then they all realized that, in fact, when they did do it, it was a huge customer acquisition platform for them.
Of course.
Have you tried, or will you, or are you thinking about trying to do a big partnership with a retailer to, by the way, liven up their spaces, because they need some love too within their four walls, so let alone people's homes. So is that something that is in the future potentially?
Absolutely, 100%. I very much appreciate, you know, I grew up in Western Massachusetts. I mentioned this in the beginning of the show. I grew up going to Walmart and Target and all of these big box retailers, and a lot of our customers are still discovering brands that way. Real estate, and I think we learned this first through our own physical stores, is such a critical part of your marketing mix. And real estate on shelf in a Target is a really great way to keep your acquisition costs low. So we are not shy about that. We absolutely would partner with a big box. I think it's actually critical to the success of consumer brands, because acquiring brands exclusively online is just massively expensive. And, you know, at the end of the day, we are not selling $900 mattresses. You know, our AOV does not allow for just exploding tax online forever and ever and ever. And so we really are looking to diversify where we show up in the world and how we show up in the world, so that customers can find us where they naturally are. And, you know, we're not here to judge you if you shop at a big box store. I love a big box store. Who doesn't? So, you know, that doesn't mean that they can't experience us in a city in one of our own stores, if that's where they happen to be, or shop online. Again, it's about being really seamless between channels.
One of the questions I always get from people who are doing, or maybe entering digital marketing or optimizing their digital marketing, is how to think about sort of metrics and statistics around how am I doing in this area, right? Am I collecting the right data? Am I analyzing my customer the right way based on how much I've spent, return on ad spend, LTV to CAC? How do you think about these metrics? Do you obsess over them, or do you give them a little bit of a arm's length, or are they as important to you as they are to some? I mean, I'm not guiding you in one way or another, because frankly, not everyone really sort of obsesses too much over them, but people do pay attention to them, maybe because the VCs do. And I don't know whether that's the right, this is probably tail wagging the dog a little bit, but anyway.
Yeah. We pay attention to customer satisfaction, and we take that very, very seriously. You know, if your CAC to LTV looks good, it's like your balance sheet. It's like one snapshot in time, and probably everyone can over-optimize that, but at what expense? And so for us, or for me at least, so certainly there are members on my team, depending on their roles, who do have specific KPIs and metrics that they track obsessively. But for me, from where I sit, customer satisfaction is the only thing that I care about, because that is the leading indicator that customers are going to come back, that they're going to tell their friends, that they're willing to increase their share of wallet with us, that they trust us. So, you know, that's something that's most critical to me. I would say that we are still of sort of a pragmatic mindset where we want the math to work. So, you know, having bootstrapped for 5 years, you know, I have not run this business like every other peer brand of ours who's raised venture capital and is willing to buy customers at any cost, because I don't believe that shakes out. So we are definitely mindful of what it costs to acquire a customer and some of those important KPIs. But I think it's a red flag when the first question that comes out of investors' mouth is, what is your CAC to LTV ratio? Because I think it means that they're overthinking, they're oversimplifying a very complex picture.
You are the first person or group to really professionalize what you're doing in your space. There are many copycats that have popped up all over North America who are probably realizing that, you know, what the hell did I get myself into two years in?
Yeah.
But in some ways they may have sort of carved a path for you in certain, you know, cities around the country. Do you think M&A roll up is something that is in your future with some of these other companies, or do you think maybe just doing it organically by retail expansion is, or maybe both? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, I think we have thought about being opportunistic because I think there's a lot of really fantastic products out there that exist, but are really sort of product businesses. They're not, you know, all encompassing brands. They're not retailers. And so the extent to which they can grow is finite. So I do think there's opportunity for roll up in that sense. With other direct competitors who are literally doing what we're doing, less so, because, you know, I think at this point we have a more sophisticated infrastructure and operation, and there's not a tremendous amount we can add on by acquiring other, you know, just D2C players. And it's a very, very hard business. So I can imagine that it's also going to be something that we just outlast a lot of these competitors. Because again, I mean, in retrospect, the fact that I did not quit, you know, 7 years ago, 8 years ago is wild. And I, you know, most of the time when I see new brands cropping up in the space, you know, I just wish them good luck, because it's a very tough business to run. This is a perishable product business and it's complicated on a lot of levels. So it's interesting. We think about the landscape in a number of ways. It really depends on what the product and approach is.
The last few years have been, as we all know, quite difficult from a supply chain perspective for many businesses. Does that apply to you? I mean, are your products homegrown United States? Does it come in from overseas? Has it been tricky for you like it has been for everybody else?
We are not immune to what's happening with global supply chain issues. So what's interesting is all of the plants are commercialized here in the US, but a lot of what we call the inputs, so whether that's young plants or seedlings, et cetera, do come in from overseas, often from the locations that the plants are native to. So, you know, a lot of house plants might be native to Africa, maybe they're native to Asia. In some cases, they're being produced in Europe. And so there was a pretty significant challenge right at the onset of the pandemic, because a lot of the industry depends on grocery store distribution. And in the beginning of the pandemic, grocery stores were actually really focused only on essentials. And so they cut a lot of their plant programs. And in that beginning moment, the industry really was challenged. They lost a ton of product to shrink because the grocery stores weren't willing to carry the product. And unbeknownst to them, there was then going to be this incredible acceleration of interest in the category. And so they've been scrambling somewhat to catch up from that moment. You know, we're now in 2022, and I would say the supply chain still isn't there. We're also being hit with incredible inflation because of the freight costs and everything that's happening in global freight. We also do source some of our planters from overseas. And, you know, as you can imagine, you know, similar story there. Freight costs are 4 times what they were 2 years ago. There's a tremendous amount of congestion. So yeah, we face all of that. And I think, you know, unfortunately, it's a very challenging narrative to then communicate to your customer who's like, why are you out of stock? Or why are your plants so expensive? And the truth is, you know, we're doing everything we can to combat that. But it's no different from any other consumer brand in our space or in any space.
So I'm going to end with two questions, the last of which will be one where I'm going to make you pick between your children. But anyway, so the first question is, are there qualities that certain plants carry that are by their inherent nature or being in the room make you feel a certain way versus another way? I mean, is there merchandising, as it were, or health merchandising around a certain plant or another one, or is it just, you know, take the one that you like and run with it?
Yeah. So all plants have benefits. They all have health benefits. They have mental health benefits. They're going to make you happy. They're going to make you more productive. They're going to make you more creative. So it's really whatever speaks to you, whatever silhouette or maintenance schedule is going to fit with your lifestyle. But one of my favorite things is actually to watch people plant shop, because people, especially in New York, they'll always surprise you by what they pull off the shelf. Even down to the specific plant they choose, they'll immediately assign it human characteristics. It immediately becomes a baby or a he or a she or a I like how his arm does this. And it's quite charming to watch.
All right. So now I'm going to make you choose, which is your favorite plant that you offer at the sale?
So, you know, it's a cliche, but our Monstera plant, which is also known as a Swiss cheese plant and has these big, broad heart-shaped leaves, is one of my all-time favorites. And it's just got this prehistoric jungle vibe. You know, you can imagine that this plant like existed with dinosaurs. And I love that because it just reminds us that plants actually predate human existence on this planet. And, you know, here we are in our, you know, tiny high-rise apartments with all of these gadgets and technology, but we still have this piece of nature sitting on our windowsill or on our desk. And I think that grounds us, and that's important.
Well, there we go. Eliza Blank reminding us that plants predate humans and that they will probably be here well after us as well. Eliza, thank you so much for joining me on the Safari. This was really fun.
Thank you, Morty.
If you want to learn a little bit more about Traub, you can go to traub.io, where you'll learn a lot about everything that we do. If you're enjoying the Safari, please do share it with your friends and colleagues within the industry. And please also don't forget to subscribe and like it. Until next time.